the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, the COP30 meeting in Brazil. Well, it's focusing on food and agriculture as well as reducing emissions. So what does that mean for Australian farmers? We'll have more on that shortly. And also Ken Henry, former Treasury Secretary, giving a big speech about the environment and the recent environment law changes. That's coming up as well, his take on that. And first to that story, he's giving a big speech shortly in regards to the environment law. He's welcomed the overall package of laws introduced to Parliament on Thursday, but he says that the vague drafting of the national interest exemption and the failure to close a few loopholes for native forest logging and land clearing were problems that need to be fixed, and also other issues in the environment as well. It comes 5 years to the day after Graham Samuel presented a scathing review of the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. Well, Ken Henry says that reform in the laws are vital to protecting our precious natural environment, and he spoke to AM about his view generally on, first of all, the legislation.
Well, they go most of the way. I don't think there can be much doubt about that. They contain some extraordinarily useful provisions. What I mean by that is provisions absent from the present Act that we've been trying to make work for 25 years. But there are a couple of things that could be improved in the legislation, But look, most importantly, the amendments contain a power for the minister to make standards that protect matters of national environmental significance. That's really important. They also contain a statutory definition of what is an unacceptable impact, and that allows or should allow developers, project developers, to get a quick no or a quicker yes on their developments. There's reforms to the offsets program. There's an independent National Environment Protection Agency and an independent Environment Information Australia. So it goes a long way, but there has been some commentary, and I've made some comments about this myself, that the laws contain a very broad national interest provision, which effectively allow the minister to override his own legislation. And in the present draft amendments, that's a very broad national interest carve-out. Mm. The second, which is probably even more troubling, really, especially when you consider the state of Queensland, is that the present legislative framework contains well-understood deforestation loopholes. I mean, some have said you could drive a motor lorry through. The deforestation loopholes allow for ongoing, very large-scale clearing of native vegetation. It's a particular issue in Queensland and also New South Wales. But in Queensland, it's somewhat perverse that a lot of the clearing that's occurring is doing considerable damage to the Great Barrier Reef, which of course is one of Queensland's most outstanding tourism attractions and job creators.
All governments do talk a big game on protecting the environment, but are they actually delivering?
No, they're not. No, they're not. I don't think they are anywhere in Australia delivering to the extent that they say that they want to. So they're not meeting their own targets, they're not meeting their own aspirations. And it's actually quite difficult for the Australian public to hold them to account because there's very little reporting of environmental outcomes, very little reporting of what the baseline is so that the electorate can check progress against baselines.
You point out that Australia needs to triple its grid capacity within the next 4 years. That's a huge amount to deliver a reliable electricity grid and remove 2.5 times more carbon than we actually do now and put that into vegetation and soils.
That's correct,
Is Australia actually capable of doing that, given the fractious debates we're having in Canberra and within the community about building new renewable energy projects and transmission lines?
Yeah, right. So those things are true. And it is a bit shocking. And if we go to 2050, it's going to have to be a sixfold increase in grid-scale renewable capacity. And those are not numbers that I've made up. These are well-accepted numbers. And yes, it is also true that the Australian landscape is going to have to, by 2050, is going to have to sequester about 2.5 times as much carbon, that is, draw that much out of the atmosphere every year as it presently does. The present fractious debate, we've had fractious debates in this country about climate change for, well, you know, I've been witness to them for more than 25 years, and nevertheless, there has been huge progress. I mean, you'd have to say that Australia's renewable energy rollout is truly extraordinary. We have not achieved so much in terms of ensuring that the Australian landscape sequesters more carbon, and that's because we've been continuing to chop down trees and clear the land, contributing to the problem, having the Australian landscape emit more carbon into the atmosphere each year rather than sequester the carbon to take it out of the atmosphere.
On a related theme, federally, the Coalition is still arguing about ditching or keeping the net zero carbon emissions policy by 2050. Do you scratch your head and wonder what's going on within the Coalition?
Well, yes, I do. I do think it is quite extraordinary. I would hope that the people who are involved in the debates in the Coalition at the moment, they've been elected by the people of Australia for a reason. What is that reason? And I would hope that in contemplating that reason, they understand the awesome responsibility that they owe to future generations of Australians, that it's their job is not all about worrying about the cost of living in the present, important as that is, but that they do whatever they can as elected officials in a functioning democracy to ensure that future generations of Australians enjoy even more opportunity than has been available to us. That's what I'd like them to focus on, and there's no way they're going to be able to argue that they're looking after future generations whilst they continue to avoid achieving net zero in a timely fashion.
Ken Henry, he'll be giving a speech, a bit of an analysis on the environment laws. He was also talking about transmission lines there and also the move to renewable energy. Well, let's stay with that theme now. And in the New England now, where some Walker farmers say that they've been caught by surprise by transmission lines. They've been voicing concerns to Energy Co about plans to change the proposed location of the New England Renewable Energy Zone transmission lines. About 400 residents attended an information session overnight, raising issues including bushfire risk and also property impacts. Reporter Peter Sanders was there.
Philippa O'Brien, my family have been in Walker since the late 1920s. I'm not immediately impacted. However, a lot of my friends are impacted.
So how do you think tonight went?
We got a lot of lip service. I don't believe our questions were properly answered. I think it was great in terms of the community showing their lack of support of this newly proposed but previously dismissed route. The Energy Co people who were there, they're doing their job, but they were unable to answer any of our concerns.
Do you feel as though any of the feedback and the concerns you did raise will be taken on board?
No, because I don't believe we have enough voters in our area to impact the government who are making these decisions. I think there's a lot of people that don't truly understand how food and fibre is produced and where it's produced and how it's produced. We can't make more prime agricultural land. I just can't find a reason why it needs to come up through this area.
Pete Young, and I'm a sheep and beef farmer in Walker. I think Walker made it really, really clear that we're very against these transmission lines. But I think they gave us a lot of bogus answers and I don't really think they listened.
Some people might say that this is a case of not in my backyard. You'd disagree with that?
Yeah, I would disagree with that. If their policy wasn't so crazy and they actually consulted and they actually didn't try to force it all on one community, people would be willing to, you know, take a portion of the load. But what they're doing is they're trying to roll over the top of us. They're trying to put like 800 turbines around Walker. If they actually did a decent job, it would be met with not such resistance. Definitely not against renewables. I think if they're done right, and that is the answer, look, more than happy, but they have to do it right, and they're not doing it right at the moment.
Do you feel like the project's being rushed at all?
Yes, this project's being rushed big time. They've moved it from Dungowan for we don't really know why, and, you know, they've got this deadline, and now they're way behind, and now they're trying to jam this down our throats.
My name's Julian Watson. I'm Deputy Project Director for the New England Renewable Energy Zone.
Julian, there was a comment made in there that changes have been made to this transmission line based on feedback. We know that the entire route was changed based off feedback. Was that comment in there about further changes?
So the changes that we will be looking to make to this new line will really be about refining the line that we have.
How can you reassure the people who came here tonight that you are listening to their feedback?
So some of the key documentation that we've heard people are keen to hear about, it involves increased information about some of the metrics and comparisons that we utilise to compare this corridor with the previous corridor. So that might include things like access track construction, it might include things like the amount of spoil that might need to be taken off the site and through local roads. It might include things like the number of towers or how those towers are constructed. There's a really large amount of information there. We think it'll provide a fair bit more understanding for people as we release that.
That's Energy Co Deputy Project Director Julian Watson ending that report from Peter Sanders. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's 16 minutes past 12. Getting quite a few texts here. People saying there was a one-sided interview with Ken Henry there, but another person said it's about time we had strict laws on land clearing. Most farmers don't care how many trees they flatten. Greg says he finds it amusing that some people jump up and down when the trees are cleared for solar and wind farms, but they do that themselves for other things on the farm. Also, someone's texted in about COP, saying that if the politicians in Brazil are really serious about stopping climate change, they need to stop using agriculture as a scapegoat and really start focusing on the biggest carbon emitters. And, yes, quite a few other texts there as well. Someone's saying, Ken Henry, we can't be green if the country is going to go rapidly bankrupt, says Chris. Well, he did address that in his speech as well. It's coming up to 18 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
Well, the COP30 meeting underway in Brazil is looking at agriculture and farming and food production, as well as carbon emission reduction in the totality as well. Richard Heath is CEO of the Zero Net Emissions for Agriculture CRC. He says this is a function of how important agriculture and beef production is to the Brazilian economy. He says farming and agriculture is seen as a special case in Brazil, as it is in Australia as well, and farmers will not be forced into a net zero position as feeding the nation is seen as a priority.
Michael, one of the really encouraging things about the Ag and Land Sector Plan that the federal government released recently as part of the scenarios to achieve zero net emissions by 2050 is that there is no expectation that agriculture will get to zero net emissions on its own. And that is a recognition of the different nature of agriculture being a biological system compared to other sectors of the economy that have much more technological pathways to achieve zero net emissions, like the energy sector, like the transport sector. So I think that, you know, there is an understanding, and that understanding is happening globally now, that agriculture is different, that food security is paramount, that while the sector should do what it can to reduce emissions, there is not the same possibility and not the same pressure on the agriculture sector that is experienced by some other sectors of the economy.
So it's about reducing emissions. It's not about planting out the whole farm with trees and then taking your carbon credits and sort of sitting back and not producing any food.
Absolutely not. And we certainly in the CRC are not doing any research that involves replacing farm productive farm businesses. We are not interested in that fence-to-fence planting of trees and turning farms into forestry. We will research where you can introduce trees into productive farming landscapes. Not replace them, but say you've got fence lines, say you've got riparian zones, say you've got areas of the farm that make sense to have trees on that don't compete with the underpinning farming business, then, yeah, obviously that's something that should be of value for reducing emissions, but also add to the farm business as well.
But so being practical and being profitable, but reducing emissions.
Exactly, yes.
Mm. And how does that fit into, like, that you mentioned the global picture there? We've got the COP30 on at the moment in Brazil, and, you know, there a number of countries are not involved because they're not on the same message in regards to reducing emissions. What do you think is likely to come out of those sort of global meetings or those global discussions about agriculture and food production and net zero?
So Brazil does have a real focus on agriculture and food production as part of these talks, which is not surprising given the nature of their economy, very big agricultural economy, a big agricultural exporter. So similar to the sorts of themes that I've just been talking about, that understanding that food security is paramount, that we can't reduce emissions at the cost to food security, at the cost to local economies and local communities that produce that food. It's self-defeating to do that. And so it is encouraging to see that that is a focus of this COP, and, you know, the implications that that might have on some of the policy outcomes to come out of it, we shall see.
But we had some quite negative talk about beef production worldwide, globally, and from some sectors here in Australia. Does that dovetail in with the sort of message your think tank is putting out there too, that, you know, we need to reduce beef production because it has some carbon issues?
We certainly don't need to reduce beef production. And again, I know I keep emphasising this, but it's really important to understand that the research that we are investing in this CRC, is how to increase beef production, but do it more efficiently in terms of the emissions profile that results from that beef production. We are going to need more protein in the world. We are going to need to continue beef production globally to feed the population. The research priority around doing that is to understand how we can increase that production while reducing emissions. The commentary, or the negative commentary, as you put it, on connecting climate action with less cows globally. Yes, it's vocal from certain sectors of the community, from certain activist groups. I don't think, other than a few jurisdictions around the world, it's really taking hold in terms of policy direction in production. I think it's a loud but minor voice, and I think that you're starting to see, as we talked about before, with things like that, you know, food and agriculture priority out of COP, that understanding that, you know, we can just do things better rather than not doing them at all.
Now, you've got some sort of you've got a toolbox of new information that can help farmers. What sort of stuff out there that maybe they don't know about that can help them, you know, in making some of these equations and changes?
Yeah, so look, we'll be releasing our Pathways Guide to Zero Net Emissions for Farmers in conjunction with our very first annual conference that's being held in Brisbane on the 28th of November. And that guide just lists practical things that can be done right now in farm businesses across all of agriculture, not just animal livestock, but in horticulture, cotton, grains as well, that we know about now. So it's not speculative technologies, it's not stuff that's yet to come to market, it's things that actually exist now that you can do in a farming business to reduce emissions in a profitable and productive way. And, you know, often they're things that you may not even realise have an emissions consequence. So things like improving weaning rates, for instance, in animal agriculture, if you have less empty cows running around that are not producing an economic output, you know, that a calf that you're rearing and taking to market, then that's less methane being emitted by an unproductive animal.
Richard Heath is the CEO of the Zero Net Emissions for Agriculture, CRC. And getting some texts on this issue. Someone's texted in about the issue of renewables and the RES, saying fair wealth distribution if farmers are inconvenienced by profit-making identities such as the solar or wind turbine companies, then those identities should be making them part of the income stream, less for one bit of and something for the other. How about free servicing or maybe some cheaper or free electricity for a start, says Lou. Dave in Condobolin says Brazil COP30 is a case of the pot calling the kettle black as massive clearing of the Amazon rainforest rages on unabated, says Dave. Land clearing there for beef production specifically as well. Someone's texted in about the RES, New England RES, saying actually it was a previous Liberal National government's plan. This person saying renewables are great, but why aren't they being put where the demand is, i.e. Sydney, which is one of the comments from one of the speakers at that Walker meeting as well. So, quite a lot of texts coming in there on that issue as well. So, we'll come back to some of those a little bit later on. It's 26 past 12.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
European breeds thrown in the mix, some Simmental and the odd Black Angus.
The Country Hour.
It's a bit of a fruit salad.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
Food of the gods.
On ABC Radio.
A worker support package has been finalised for employees at the 6 timber mills on the north coast directly impacted by the moratorium on timber harvesting in the Great Koala National Park. It includes payments for relocation, education and training, as well as free access to mental health support and additional support for employees over 45 years old. Minister for the North Coast, Janelle Saffin, explained what's in the package.
There was a worker support package and that was always open to negotiation and consultation with the trade unions, the workers and industry. And since the announcement, the weeks that followed, we've been in those negotiations, myself, Minister Sharp, Minister Moriarty, and we've sort of landed on a package that recognises the impact on employees and it provides additional financial support, practical support and assist with re-employment as well or career change and, you know, support the workers and their families through this time. With the redundancy payments that they would already get, there'll be an extra 4 weeks base pay for each year of employment with people who are impacted in the timber mill or the harvesting operator and additional support for employees over 45 years and education and training, relocation payments, etc. Look, no worker would want to lose their job or go away from their job. I understand that, but this is a suitable package for them.
What's your response in regards to the Nationals kind of coming out as a united front and saying, well, you know, this is just a little showboat of an election promise?
You know, not to be unkind, but the Nationals would say that. You know, they've never do anything to save koalas. There's been many studies done over a long period of time. A study that was done on the Great Koala National Park, it used drones, it used enhanced technology. Koalas are at risk, we know that. And you can cherry pick studies. I've read them all, I've looked at them. And all of them, the fact is koalas are at risk and they're on the road to extinction by 2050. And that's why the Great Koala National Park is being created. That's the reality.
That's Janelle Saffin there, the Minister for North Coast, speaking there with reporter Sophia McCaffin. Well, let's turn our attention now to other support packages, this time for the prawn industry. Clarence River prawn fisher says he's unsure about the future of his industry as the end of a support package for fishers affected by white spot nears. The sale of green prawns from the Clarence River has been banned since mid-2023 after a virus was found there in the catchment. There's hopes a two-year proof of freedom process would lead to a reopening of the local green prawn industry, but the disease was detected in offshore wild prawns earlier this year. Fisher and spokesman for the local prawn committee, Glenn Dawson, told Charles Rushworth he can't see a return to normal operations at this stage.
While we've got this closure hanging over the top of us, we look like we're going to be declared a white spot zone, and there's no track for a proof of freedom from here on. That's the way we understand it at the moment. So really, we can't go back to work unless we're going to cook prawns, and the Clarence is not really noted for cooking prawns. We're predominantly a green prawn bait market up here, and that's not much of a future for us. We've searched and tried to source markets for cooked smaller prawn from here on, because that's the only way we can land a prawn is if it's cooked from now on. Those markets are just predominantly not there at the moment.
What support at the moment, what support packages for impacted fishers are in place, and what's working as well?
We've had a support package put in place for the last 6 months, but we're yet to see that money. That money was supposed to be due on the first week in November. We're yet to see that, so we're just waiting on that one.
Yeah, right. How much money was that again?
It's for 6 months. The money we received over the 2 years, it was the same format that was used for that, only there was a six-month payment to get us up until the 9th of December. I think it's a roughly around $1.1 million to cover the whole fishery. That includes us and the Richmond, so it's not a lot of money we're talking about.
Clarence River prawn fisher Glenn Dawson speaking there to Charles Rushworth. The ABC has contacted the Agriculture Minister for comment. It's coming up to 28 minutes to one. Still lots of texts coming through about a range of issues, about Ken Henry, about the COP in Brazil, about renewable energy. So we'll try and get to them. I mean, literally, I've got a full board of texts coming through, like hundreds of texts coming through, so quite incredible, but I don't think I'll get to all of them anyway, so we'll try and do our best. But first let's get some news headlines from Adam Story. Good afternoon.
I won't take up too much of the time. I know you've got a lot to get to.
No. Tell us the news, that's fine.
Well, it's probably something you don't already know, but the Liberals are meeting in Canberra to discuss their position on net zero. Now, this will be ahead of a Liberal shadow ministry meeting tomorrow, where they'll further discuss the position before they attempt to reach an agreement as a coalition with the Nationals, who have already abandoned the net zero target. Meanwhile, three MPs were a bit late in getting to the meeting. That was after their Qantas flight was diverted. Leah Blythe, Tony Posen and Andrew McLaughlin were on the plane that was forced to return to Adelaide after crews noticed smoke in the cabin. Qantas says the captain requested a priority landing due to a technical issue, but the Liberals have made their way to Canberra and the meeting is now underway. The Premier has admitted there was a communication breakdown regarding that neo-Nazi rally over the weekend and out the front of State Parliament. He says security for both State Parliament and the Premier's department knew about the rally. He says police told both parliamentary security and security at the Premier's department about the protests, but neither of the teams informed him or other MPs about the rally. The food delivery company Menulog has announced it's going to shut down in 2 weeks. Michael, what are you going to do for dinner now?
Well, at least they won't have to suffer through those ads.
No, that's true. That's actually... Are your food turning up, Cole? Mm. They're closing, taking last orders from midnight Wednesday, the 26th of November, the latest casualty in the very competitive food delivery business. That follows the collapse of Deliveroo and Foodora, who've closed in recent years.
Might have to go to the shops.
Might have to actually go to the supermarket and buy and cook. God forbid.
Yep.
Yeah. And we owe the Russians some money, even though they've lost the battle in the High Court over the site for a new embassy in Canberra. It's the federal government has been told it has to compensate the Russian Federation for revoking its lease. The lease was originally granted in 2008 but withdrawn when the parliament passed new laws in 2023, citing advice from OSIO that the embassy could pose a threat to national security. Now, lawyers for Russia argued that law was invalid, but the High Court found the law is valid, but Russia is entitled to just terms compensation.
Right. So we've got to pay them some money.
Yes.
Do we know how much?
No, we haven't got a figure yet.
Okay.
No. No. I suppose that'll be discussed behind closed doors, perhaps.
Yes.
All right.
And those lawyers don't come cheap.
No, not the High Court ones, no.
All right, thanks for that, Adam.
Okay, get to those texts.
Yes, yeah. And you'll be back at 1 o'clock.
I'll be back.
Let's find out what's happening with the weather. Alenka Dumas at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So the wild weather we were talking about before, or the rain and some of the stormy activity, has moved through now?
It certainly has moved through, and we're currently sitting under a high-pressure system, which is bringing very stable weather, clear skies and plenty of sunshine. But it also did bring quite a cold morning for November in particular across many areas of New South Wales, but in particular about the central west and southeastern parts, where we did see quite a few records broken for November minimum temperatures. So a lot of those locations were around that central west and southeast, places like Braidwood, Tuggeranong, Orange, Cootamundra, Tamora, Cowra, Albion Park, Nowra, to name a few, all broke.
Well, that's a few, isn't it?
Yeah, quite a few.
Cooma had minus 4.5 apparently overnight as well.
Yeah, that's correct. Not quite a November record, but yeah, there were several locations that did break their overnight minimum November record. So it was a cool start.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the temperature drop in the Monaro in a moment. And what's likely to happen is there is a change coming on the weekend, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So fairly similar conditions expected tomorrow. Still some frost about, but not expecting quite as cold a morning. But by Friday and throughout the weekend, we will see a low pressure system and a trough move across New South Wales. So that is expected to bring showers and thunderstorms to most areas. On Friday, the focus will mostly be across the northern and northeastern parts of the state, where we will see fairly widespread shower activity and scattered thunderstorm activity. And then that system moves further east, so we'll see that activity more likely about eastern and central areas. But it looks like about the northeastern sort of quarter of the state is where we will see most of the rainfall. Widespread daily totals of anywhere from 5 to 25 millimetres is likely. And with thunderstorms, we could see some isolated higher falls of daily falls of 30 to 45 millimetres, mostly about the northwest slopes and plains, northern tablelands, and potentially parts of the northern rivers and mid-north coast. So definitely more that northeast corner is where we'll see more of that rainfall, but anywhere about the eastern and central west as well could see some storms and showers as well.
Yeah, and we're hearing from grain farmers. I think at Moree they might have nearly just about finished the harvest, but Liverpool Plains sort of further south, they are harvesting. So are they going to cop a fair bit of rain, and is it going to last for a few days, or is it just going to be over a day or so?
Yeah, they could cop a bit of rain, probably Friday and then Saturday night into Sunday morning.
Like sort of Gunnedah, Mullally, that sort of area?
Yeah, that's correct. So probably Friday's more stormy, more convective, but then Saturday night into Sunday, it does look like it may get a little bit more rainy, so a bit more consistent rainfall. But yeah, a lot of our guidance is starting to firm up at the moment, so it does look like it will be wettest in that period, sort of Saturday night into Sunday. So definitely still monitor the forecast because it is still evolving, and it's more with the deepening of this trough. So where that trough is positioned over the weekend as it deepens, that's where we'll see most of the rainfall. At this stage, it does look like about that northwest slopes and plains, northern tablelands, but it could shift further east or west in the coming days. So just monitor the forecast.
So Tamworth, Walgett maybe as well, Wee War getting some rain too, that sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely.
Sort of 20 millimetres minimum and maybe more with thunderstorms?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, so that's probably is going to slow down the harvest a bit. I guess with harvest, they can probably take a day or so of rain. It's not going to stretch on for like a week or 7 days or something like that.
No. By Monday, this system should move rapidly east, so we'll see fairly dry conditions Tuesday and Wednesday and possibly even into Thursday next week. So it's definitely not lingering, but at least Friday to Sunday, we'll definitely see some showers and storms in that region.
Okay, Alenka, thanks for that.
Thanks very much, Michael.
It's 21 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Spring across Monero. We've been talking about that and the weather. It's been a bit of a mixed picture this year. In the south, recent rain has come at the right time, but other areas are facing a failed spring. Temperatures dropped to -4.5 in Cooma overnight, and parts of the southeast recorded snow and hail yesterday as well. There are concerns that the late frosts may have damaged some drought-affected crops. Angus Hobson runs sheep and cattle on the Monero, and he told Josh Becker the recent rain has helped the outlook for his farm.
I've got to say we've been pretty fortunate that we've had I'd say the theme for this spring's better late than never. I just tallied it up this morning. We've had bang on 80 millimetres for since 27th of October, so just over 2 weeks.
That's pretty handy because it was looking quite dry and a little dire in certain parts of the Monero.
It was. I think we were tracking, the Monero was tracking, southern Monero in particular, was tracking pretty well up until the end of August. We had a big snow event then, which is to be expected, but September is what did the damage. I looked up our records and we had 3.6 millimetres for September, and typically we'd go 65 to 70 millimetres as a monthly rainfall for September. So things are looking pretty good here now. I think we'll get a half-handy spring. I certainly hope people to our north, we had some friends down working yesterday who are in country just south of Cooma, and it's the tail of two areas completely opposite to the northern Monero, so hopefully we'll see some reprieve for that area soon too.
Yeah, a really mixed bag across the Monero is what we're sort of hearing at the moment. What about these temperatures? -4.5 in Cooma overnight, and I think you had a bit of snow or at least sleet yesterday. Is this pretty unusual to get snow and this time in November?
It is, Josh. I mean, I think anything's possible on the Monero. I'm pulled up at the moment just looking at the main range has obviously had a fair old dusting overnight. It's looking a lot whiter. We got just light snow flurries yesterday, but I think the real wind chill came in. Having said that, I looked up some records only a couple of years ago, the 14th of December, and we had 4 inches of snow. So I think anything's possible on the Monero.
So how are you feeling about the outlook for the rest of spring and the summer ahead? It sounds like with that level of moisture and temperatures, you know, hopefully warming up, you might be able to get some significant growth and things might be looking good in the weeks and months ahead.
I think so, Josh. I think we'll do okay now. Certainly feel a bigger safety margin of soil moisture. We did fallow a few paddocks early, it was only as late as late October that it had a very different feel, these weather patterns. So we were fallowing paddocks early just to make sure we had moisture for late summer, autumn sowing. But I think we'll be fine now. We've put in a little bit of summer crop and just for young stock. So hopefully, at least till Christmas, I think things will be looking pretty good.
Joe Powles is Senior Ag Advisor with Local Land Services. She says it's a mixed bag across the Monero, with some areas where it's incredibly dry.
It's been another challenging one, generally speaking, across the district. I think some parts of the district started in a reasonable position as we headed into spring, particularly sort of the southern region. But that lack of rainfall through sort of those crucial months of sort of September and October have really set us back a fair way. And for a lot of us in sort of the more central parts of the district, this is just a repeat of what happened last year as well. So for a lot of us, there's been two sort of springs that have failed and haven't delivered for us. But in true Monero standards, you know, if we get rain in the coming weeks, it's not all over yet. We may get a late spring. For some of us, it may not bring us back to where we want to be for a spring, but it would be a start.
when you look at things like soil moisture and I guess how dry it is around that Cooma region, how significant is it in your mind?
Look, it is incredibly dry. The Farming Forecaster Soil Moisture Probe Network has just demonstrated to us, you know, how dry some of these sites are. Was just looking at some again in the last couple of days, and we've got sites that have been sitting in the lowest percentile of soil moisture for well over a month now. And you can't have spring growth on a soil with no moisture in it, particularly when it doesn't rain. So it's been, you know, incredibly dry. Again, the central parts and northern areas of the district didn't have a lot of rain heading into winter. And have just been living on, you know, the small showers that have come through as the season's progressed. But it's been pretty challenging, and yeah, there are a lot of stock out there that are still searching for that green pick.
Joe Powles is a senior ag advisor with Local Land Services. That report put together by Josh Becker.
You're listening to the Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. Victoria seeks adult jail sentences for children aged 14 and over who commit serious violent crimes. The Federal Liberal Party gathers to discuss their net zero policy by 2050. Reports that the UK has stopped sharing intelligence with the US over possible strikes on Venezuela. And a world record attempt for the most number of bagpipers in Melbourne with an AC/DC twist. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
Here on the Country, our Australian farmers will be watching closely as the government of the biggest buyer of Aussie beef says it will investigate what it says is collusion in the meat industry. United States President Donald Trump has called for the investigation, saying beef processors are driving up prices through illicit collusion, price fixing and price manipulation that's jeopardising the nation's food supply. Here's how the American media is reporting the news.
President Trump ordering a DOJ investigation into foreign meat packers, accusing them of inflating U.S. beef prices.
President Trump accusing four of the biggest meat packing companies of driving up U.S. beef prices, which hit record highs in August.
Really expensive right now, right, at the grocery store. The president now looking into it. You could say he has beef with this particular industry here by looking into what he's calling illicit collusion, price fixing and price manipulation against companies that pack America's meat.
Beef is a big part of the freedom in this country, and I always say where there is beef, there is freedom, and that's what I believe.
I agree.
But analysts are questioning whether America's expensive beef is actually the fault of the meat packers. Warwick Long spoke to Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends, who says he doesn't agree with President Trump.
Reality is that meat processing companies in America have been losing near on $270 per animal since February this year. So if it's collusion, then it's collusion on how to lose money, which doesn't make sense. So, no, to me, you know, it's reaching out, looking to blame someone for effectively what are very high retail prices. So it's a pretty simple equation, Warwick. If you look at the value of beef and in terms of cattle and the price rise that we've seen over the last year, which is 22 to 32%, depending on the month, and you look at what, you know, we've seen in terms of retail on wholesale prices, retail's only up 8.3% in that same period. Wholesale's up, you know, probably closer to 17%. So the sums don't add up. There's simply not enough cattle in the system.
President Trump was elected on the basis of, well, partly because grocery prices were going up and he said he could lower them. Meat prices have continued to go up. So he's looking for someone to blame. He says it's the meat packing companies, but you're saying the data doesn't support that.
No, I mean, the July figures came out on their herd inventory. You know, they started collecting those in the mid-70s, and it's the lowest ever since the mid-70s, came in at 94.2 million. So, Warwick, it's just fundamentals. They've depleted their herd for the last, you know, 3 to 4 years due to very severe drought. So this is just a demand and supply problem.
Let's have a look then at the state of the US meat industry at the moment. Four large companies dominate 85% of beef processing in America. That's part of what the president wants to look at there. But you say all four are currently losing money.
They are, and this isn't the first year this is the case. So let's look at the largest, which is Tyson Foods, Warwick. And last year, in 2024, they lost the equivalent of $587 million Australian. When you simply do not have the supply and you're trying to maintain workers plus high input costs, Warwick, the sums simply don't add up at the moment for a US beef processor. Basically, Cargill and Tyson's are the two US companies, and then you've got JBS and National Foods, which are effectively Brazilian-owned. And trust me, if they could make a dollar, they would be. There is no collusion given these enormous losses.
Simon Quilty was speaking there to Warwick Long. Well, conservation dogs are being deployed across the Lower Murray River to sniff out freshwater turtle nests. The native freshwater turtle populations have declined by 91% across the Lower Murray in the past 40 years. Conservation dog handler Fiona Jackson's been out in South Australia's Riverland region to train these dogs for their new role.
Takes a bit of work, but what we're doing with our three dogs here is we're getting substrate from the natural environment and adding some colloquial fluid, some turtle fluid, to the substrate, and training with the dogs that anytime they sniff out that odour, they get rewarded. So anytime they sniff out, they get rewarded with either a little bit of food or their absolute favourite thing, which is a ball.
Why are they such a good tool in the detection process?
Dogs in general, as a methodology, because of their sense of smell, it's just so incredible. People say researchers say it's anywhere between 10,000 and 100,000 times better than our sense of smell. So anything that we're struggling to find in the natural environment, like turtle nests, you can deploy a dog. That technology of their sense of smell can be a real aid in finding those nests or anything that's really difficult for us as humans, either as spotters or other methodologies that struggles.
How effective are they in finding the nests? I know it's a relatively new process.
Yeah, so we are still training. We've just started this week. Actually, in fact, last week we just introduced the dogs to the odour. So the training wheels are very much still on for our three. But that being said, there's other groups around Australia and across the world who have done this successfully, so it can be done. People up in New South Wales, over in Western Australia, and even in Victoria, actually, who have all successfully worked with conservation detection dogs to find turtle nests. So we're confident that once our lot are trained up, they'll be able to do the same and help out here.
How long is that training process?
In terms of scent imprinting the dog on the odour, it takes a couple of weeks. Then you've got to get the dog out, which is what we're doing this week, is get the dog out in the natural environment, get them used to this environment. And it then becomes very much a process of calibrating the dog across all the different odour possibilities and complexities that there are in the natural environment. So it's hard to say, but in terms of if you have a brand new dog, if you have a dog from pup, it can take anywhere to 12 months to 18 months to get a dog up and running. But thankfully, the dogs that we put on this project are already experienced, so they have all their safety and welfare instructions in place, so they're very safe in the natural environment, which is super important to us. So we're hoping after a month or two of training on this odour specifically that they'll be ready and really calibrated to the odour to help and do searches in the natural environment here.
Talking about the situation with those turtle sniffer dogs, that's conservation dog handler Fiona Jackson speaking to Anita Ward. Time for markets. First up, casino cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers are similar to last week for a yarding of 1,323 head, consisting of a good supply of young cattle and around 470 cows. Quality was mixed and the young cattle consisted mainly of weaners and a few pens of yearlings. Most of the young cattle went to restockers in a stronger market, with restocker weaner steers selling 20 to 30 cents dearer, depending on weight and breed. They sell from 400 to 588 cents, with the medium weights averaging 532. Restock weaner heifers were 20 cents dearer, 360 to 480 cents. Yearling steers to the background, 438 to 570. Restocker yearling heifers ranged from 366 to 416, and the trade heifers sold from 468 to 410 cents. The few pens of bullocks and steers met a strong market. They sold from 400 to 450. Grown heifers sold up to 415. Again, another strong cow market. Three score cows were 10 to 15 cents dearer. They sold from 380 to 405 cents. And the heavy D4s, 10 dearer, selling from 394 to 426 cents. Best of the heavy bulls, 415 cents. Doug Robson at Casino.
Let's go to Carcor Sheep and Lambs.
Numbers lifted by 5,100 for a yearling of 11,600 lambs. Quarterly was good with large supplies of new season straw lambs on offer, along with good numbers of new season trade and heavyweight lambs. All the regular buyers were operating, along with additional buyers seeking straw lambs. Competition was strong in all categories and the market sold dearer. Lightweight new season lambs to process sold from 120 to 220. New season trade weights 20 to 24 kilos lifted 10, selling from 234 to 295, averaging 1150 to 1200 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavyweights over 24 kilos lifted 15, 320 to 370, averaging around 1240 cents per kilo. New season straw lambs gained 30, they sold from 140 to 250. Heavy hoggets reached 282. There was 3,000 mixed quality mutton yard and prices were firm to cheaper. Merino ewes sold from 98 to 200 and crossbred ewes 128 to 265. Merino wethers sold from 115 to 220 and crossbred wethers 190 to 228. Heavy crossbred rams sold to 180. Most sheep sold in the range of 660 to 730 cents per kilo. This is Angus Fierce, MLA at CTLX.
Let's go to Cara Sheep and Lambs now. Rob Pearce is there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. There were 4,800 lambs, up by 1,100. Quality is very good for the Shawn new seasons. Woolly lines were showing signs of dryness, and they were mainly trade and heavies. Pen stores increased in supply. Medium and heavy trade new seasons were firm to one dearer. 2022 kilos, 233 to 262. 22 to 24, 274 to 295, averaging 1140 to 1195 cents. Heavyweights were firm to 11 dearer. 24 to 26, 296 to 330. 26 plus, 325 to 376, averaging 1090 to 1220 cents. Stores sold from 120 to 237, up $2 to $7. Mutton numbers lifted by 250 for 1900. Quality was good. Medium weight sheep were 6 to 10 dearer. Medium first cross ewes 155 to 176, averaging 715 cents. And this has been Rob Pearce from MLA at Cowra.
Thanks, Rob. Let's go to Yas.
Good afternoon. The lamb numbers lifted to 10,400, including 6,300 new season lambs. The quality was good. There were plenty of store lambs and more trade and heavyweights. The market sold to a stronger trend. Restocking new season lambs jumped 15 to 20, with lambs to 18 kilos selling from 131 to 235, averaging 1250. The trades were $20 dearer, 225 to 287. They averaged 1150. Heavyweights 297 to $336, or 1120 cents on average. The old or shorn trade lambs were 10 to 15 better, 215 to 269. Shorn heavyweights 283 to 335, with they averaged 1160 for lambs with weight. The best hogget reached 320. They were up $20. Mutton numbers lifted. Prices were strong. Medium weight ewes 120 to 207. Heavy crossbreds reached 272 and merinos 260. Most range from 740 to 800 cents.
To Mossvale.
Good afternoon, Michael. Numbers jumped by over 600 for a total yearling of 2,145, fair to good quality cattle. There was some good runs of well-finished yearlings to suit the trade, and there was an increased number of cattle to suit the feedlot buyers. There were some good runs of heavy grain cattle and 240 cows. The buyers were not as active, resulting in mostly cheaper price trends. Trade yearlings 450 to 542, feeder steers firmed a few cents easier, 414 to 516, heifers to feed also cheaper to average 450. Young cattle returning the paddock did not attract the competition of previous sales, with the well-bred steers selling from 346 to 600 cents and heifers 320 to 470. Heavy grain steers, price unchanged, reaching 462. Grown heifers topped at 452 to average 435. 2 and 3 score cows firm, 280 to 400. Heavy prime cows, D's 10, topping at 450 to average 401 cents per kilo. Just been in the UK where sirloin steak was £40 per kilo or $85. Fillet steak, £67 or $135 per kilo. This is David Kent at Mossvale for MLA.
Let's go to Singleton Cattle now.
Good afternoon. A surge of 50% of the numbers saw Singleton agents yard 1,258 cattle. Quality was generally high with bigger lines and penfuls of weaners and yearlings. Cow numbers spiked to around 200 and the market fluctuated throughout. The frantic activity of last week to secure steer calves not to the same levels, as very few light steer calves were on offer today in comparison, and they traded 18 cents a kilo cheaper, selling from 420 to 538. Heavier types over 330 kilos also trending cheaper, and they made from 430 to 566. Light heifer calves firmed a slightly easier, 355 to 448, with medium and heavyweight heifer calves enjoying rises of 7 to 17 cents a kilo, and they traded between 380 and 442. Superb runs of crossbred and straightbred yearling steers and heifers saw medium and heavy yearling steers attract strong competition to be 10 to 16 cents a kilo dearer and more in places to both restock and feed, and they sold from 400 to 590. Heavy yearling heifers jumped 26 cents a kilo and they averaged around 426. Two score cows dropped 24 cents a kilo and they made from 240 to 386.
And it's one